Joe Ward is another old-timer on the Porcupine. He came to Alaska in the early 1900s from England, coming over the pass and down the Yukon by boat to Dawson City. Later, he floated on down to Rubber Creek, where he worked for a short time for the old crusty German named Weber. Perhaps some here have read the book Trials, Trails, and Tribulations by Judge Wickersham. He tells all about this old German in his book, who had a roadhouse where Rubber Creek is now. Weber also cut wood for the steamboats. If you don't mind, I'd like to tell a story right there that Judge Wickersham tells. I'm sure that perhaps some people here have heard it, but if you haven't, I thought it was a very nice one. Judge Wickersham, we know, was our first judge here in the territory here, and his district extended from Eagle to Rampart. He traveled this in winter, and he traveled it in summer. Travels in winter by dog team, and in summer by boat. One summer, when he was coming down river to hold court, the boat tied up at Fort Yukon. And on the bank is a very pretty Indian girl. And on the boat was a fire red-haired man on the boat. When they put the gangplank down, this red-headed man went across the gangplank and went up naturally, as all men, single men and some married men do. Right away, he started to talk to the girl, a pretty Indian girl. And they both disappeared into the NC store. And about 30 minutes later, the captain blew the horn for everybody to come aboard that he was moving down river. Out bounds a red-headed boy and goes aboard the boat. Next year, when the judge was coming down about the same time on the boat, there were three old ladies, but they were tourists. And people who know elderly ladies who are tourists know there's hardly anything escape their eyes. They want to know just everything that they see, and naturally, and I do too. I'm not talking against them, you understand, but they are that way. I think maybe some people will bear me out. So this time, these three tourist old ladies was on the boat. And when they got to Port Yukon, lo and behold, here was that same Indian girl on the bank. She had a blanket over her back, but you could see she had a big hump in the blanket. And so these ladies, they noticed this Indian girl, and they went up and talked to her, you know. And she talked with them, and they wanted to know if it was a baby, which they suspected. And they told me, yes, it was a baby. Well, not being satisfied yet, they want to see the baby. So then she took off the blanket off of the baby, and lo and behold, it had fire red hair. But they weren't satisfied yet. These ladies weren't. They says to the Indian girl, did the father have red hair? And the Indian girl says, I don't know. He never took his hat off. Joe Ward, after he left Weber Creek, came down to Fort Yukon and then went up about 90 miles up to Porcupine, which is about 4 miles above Schumann House there, and built a trapping cabin. He lived there for well over 40 years. He's retired now and lives in Fort Yukon. He had one of the best writing camps in the country. Sometimes he, his Indian wife and son, trapped and shot over 3,000 rats and other furs. One time he made a record catch of 400 link. I would like to say that there are a number of experienced canoeists here in Fairbanks. My good friends and neighbors, Elkan and Ann Morris, Dr. John Tryon from the University at College, is an enthusiastic canoeist and started a canoe club here, naming it the Canoe Club of 65 North. Nowadays, with our present day maps that show the rapids, canyons, falls, and portages, one can plan a trip I first wrote this, I said, one can plan a trip to the most remote areas. Now, I'm a little bit wrong on that, so I injected a word here. I said, when one plans a trip, he can plan a trip in Canada. The Canadian maps are the ones that plot the portages and the rapids and the falls. I have not checked this thoroughly. Robert there probably set me straight on that. Am I right? Are the portages and falls plotted on the maps?
Yes.
On the Alaskan maps?
On a few rivers. It's just been in the last, within the last year, our Bureau has published a little map called Canoe Trails of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
That shows portages and rapids on a half a dozen rivers in Alaska.
I think the reason for the Canadian maps having on the borders, because to a lot of Americans they just can't realize. Can you think for a moment that Fort Nelson was built in 1800, and can you further think that Fort McPherson was built in 1840? Some of the North Country was named, the rivers was named, the portage was charted, the falls were located, and lots of places had place names long before our West had any people to speak of at all. Another thing a lot of people, Americans, don't realize, the first man that went across North America was not Lewis and Clark. It was Alexander Mackenzie. He went across in 1793. Lewis and Clark went across in 1804. So I just mentioned that. I think maybe that's the reason why our Canadian maps, because he's in Canada. What built Canada is the fur trade. And they had two seasons usually in Canada, and it was the canoe season and the dog season. And so much, practically all the travel in Canada was either by dogs or by canoe. So I presume that's why in Canada, these old canoe routes that was used several hundred years, I guess I could say, I charted on those maps. So I say here that nowadays, with our present-day maps that show the rapids, canyons, falls, and portages, one can plan a trip to the most remote areas, such as the Copper Mine, the Dubon, the Thelon, the Hanbury, Back, and others. I'd like to mention right here now, comparing that with the old Sardos. You take a present-day map, say a map like most of the Canadian maps. All the falls and rapids and portages are marked. Whereas in the old Sardo days up here, they didn't know what in the world was around the next bend. So how much advantage we have today in making. One other thing I'd like to make a comment on too is for a person to think for a moment of traveling all these rivers both ways, up the Yukon, down the Yukon, and all these many rivers that the Sardos did, and they did it with a pole and a tracking line. Here we have mortars, powerful mortars, goes up 75 horsepower. So it's really something to think on. The difference in the early days when the Sardos pulled up the rivers and floated down the rivers, and the day like now when we have these big motors to depend upon. However, they have their disadvantage too. They have to take a tremendous amount of gasoline to run a good sized motor. And when you depend upon gasoline only, you can go just as far as your gasoline, and then you're out of luck. But with the paddle, you can go just as far as a grub blast. I plan next year a paddle trip through the Bering Grounds and down the Thelon River. I planned that trip 16 years ago. I wanted to start at Fort St. John. I went down the Peace River, to the Slave River, to the Great Slave Lake, and east from the Great Slave Lake to the east end, and then there's what they call Pike's Portage. Warburton Pike went over there in about 1896. And in those early days, they take a spruce tree and they lob it off in different shapes. Maybe they just leave the top of it on. And that tree stood there for many years, and that was what quite was called the Pike's Portage. And it's about 30 miles then to Artillery Lake. And this is one way to, for canoers to take a trip right across North America, almost. So next year I hope to make this trip. In closing here, I feel quite honored that the president of the Historical Society thought my experiences by canoe in our wonderful Northland worthy of recording. I thank him, and I hope that I have not been a disappointment. I thank you all for being so patient with me. So I do thank you.
Well, thank you. I'll tell you, you had a wonderful story that was well told, and I'm sure that many people here have questions that they would like to ask you. Possibly first you could point out these points, places on the map as we travel. And I know that they have questions that they'd like to ask you.
Well, it doesn't go quite far enough, a little bit south. But from Fairbanks here, passes on down to Toll and Whitehorse. Where is Whitehorse? Down here someplace. I'm just going on down here. And it goes on down to Fort Nelson. Most people here have driven up the Alaska Highway and know where Fort Nelson is. And just 3 miles below Fort Nelson there, the bridge goes over a river called the Musqua. As I mentioned, that's named as a local Indian word for bear. A little something interesting right there. The first, why it was named Fort Nelson. Fort Nelson was established by the Northwest Fur Company in about 1800, and it was called Fort Nelson. And then when they built the Alaska Highway, there was staging area made there, close by. I'd say it's about 9 miles from there. And so at that time, though, it was called Musqua. And a little bit later then, they took the name from the old fur trading post, and we know it as Fort Nelson, but it's really Musqua, named after the river, which is close by. About 3 miles below there then, I put in and on this river. And it's just a short distance down to the Fort Nelson River. And then just below there is where you pass the old fur trading post, on the right bank there. And then I went down, I'm still not caught up here with this map, but then I went down there about 100 miles to this river here, the Yard River. This is originally, I think, a Scots word, but the French have been using it, I understand, looking back on my history books. Right. At first was, however, the way I understood it, it was first a Scots word. Then it was taken by the French, and papo is another form of cottonwood tree. And the cottonwood trees along that river are different than the cottonwood trees around here. The whole trunk, all the way up to the very top, is real pretty chalk white, where our cottonwood trees around here have that real hard bark, rough bark. And so I hit the Liard there, and I went down to Fort Nelson on the Mackenzie River. So I'm still about right down here. And I went up to Mackenzie here. By the way, if anybody is going down there next year, of course they're going to know about this, but the Wrigley, this Wrigley here has moved up and across the river about 9 miles. And this is the Mackenzie River here. And this is the Delta. This Delta is about 100 miles right straight from point separation to the sea. And it's about 50 miles wide. A Klavik is about 75 river miles from Inuvik. And it's about 35 air miles. So this time, I went down the Husky Channel and went to a Klavik. That was my first trip down to a Klavik. Then we flew up there to McDougal's Pass. Well, I'm in here someplace.
and then with the little bell. And by the way, this bell, John Bell was the one that built Fort McPherson, and he was the one that discovered this pass, and he is the one that the Bell River is named after. He didn't like the North Country very well. Funny. So he come down here to the Porcupine, like I did, and then on down the Porcupine to the Yukon. And that is it.
Well, is there anything left at LaPierre House?
No. I've been checking up on that, Charles. And I wrote a letter to the Historical Society in Yukon Territory. I didn't know the address, and I'm not sure if that is even the name for it. But I called it that, and I addressed it to the Chamber of Commerce. And I told them that I passed through there three times now, and I've tried hard to locate the Pier House, but I couldn't find it. And I suggest to them an Indian who lives below the mouth of the Bell by the name of Teza.
Moses.
Is that, what is it?
Teza.
What, can you remember his first name?
Moses.
That's it, Moses Teza. And I talk with him too up there. I know him now quite a long time, you know, just a talking to him. And I suggested to this society here, Historic Society, that they might ask him, if he goes up that way, that he could just make some blazes on a tree. And that would do until they found time to put some kind of a marker there. I know too that just like Alaska here, the Yukon Territory no doubt has many, many places of historical interest. And so it's probably pretty hard to get around to all these places. I never received any answer from them, but I also suggested that they could do that, then to put it on their agenda.
Well, in Jess's diary, when he went up there with the Murrays in 1926, he mentions a LaPierre House.
That's right. Those ladies were two English ladies.
Yes, he mentions that.
Yes, V-Y-V-Y-A-N, title ladies. And they had two Indians help them up the rat, and they went to LaPierre House. That's where they left these Indians. And that's where these Indians then walked across that 80-mile portage. And they were in existence then. And another interesting thing, right, am I taking too much time?
No. Make yourself comfortable. Sit down and make yourself comfortable.
Another interesting thing, the Hoover magazine is just a wonderful magazine about the North Country. And I'd like to suggest to you people who are interested in the North Country, they ought to take a copy of that. It comes quarterly. Well, anyway.
Jess always took the Beaver magazine.
You bet.
Dropped it since.
Are you? That's shame on you then.
I should have kept it.
There's a young girl who was the daughter of Colleen, I think the name was McDonald, at Fort Chipewyan on Lake Athabasca. She was about 13 years old, and her parents, this was in about 1840. No, yes. Yeah, it'd be about 1840. And her father was chief factor there, and he asked this man who invented these Indian syllabics, and which had been used all out to the North Country. He asked him to take this girl and start her education. So he took her, but she didn't stay very long with him. Then she went on down south to Fort Garry. That is now Winnipeg. And she was there for 4 years. And then she was on her way back in a York boat. That is part of the way, in a York boat. That was the boat was used immediately after they started discontinued the canoe. It's about a 40-foot boat, and it's a very clumsy thing, but it has a wonderful capacity as compared with a canoe. Well, she started north then to go back home, and on this same boat, the man that built Fort Yukon, Alexander Hunter Murray, he's a single man, and naturally, like all men, he knows this young girl. And so they were married on boat. In those days, a chief factor had the authority to marry people in that nature. And I might just inject right there, just for a second, Mr. Brower up here at Point Barrow, the way he used to marry people up there, he'd get a Susan Roebuck catalog and stand the people up in front of him and read an advertisement out of it. But anyway, this couple was married en route. And this Alexander Hunter Murray, he was on his way then to build Fort Yukon. And he came as far as Fort McPherson, and they wintered there. And in the early spring, this is the part I wanted to remind me of this. In the early spring, he took his young wife, before breakup, over this 80-mile portage to LePere House. And he left her there. He left her there because he was en route to Fort Yukon to build Fort Yukon. But can you just imagine now, this girl was 17 years old. Wasn't that a really a honeymoon trip for her? She lived there for about a year. She lived there from the spring then until the following spring. Her first child was born there. They had, there was about three cabins there at that time. The LePere House is, there were originally about three cabins away, the way I've heard about it. And it was really an outpost from McPherson. And like I mentioned, goods would be brought over this portage here and deposited there, and then later they was taken on down the boat. And you know, they went as far as Fort Selkirk for a while. There was a man there, Chief Factor Campbell, and he was the first man that really connected up the Yukon. We knew where the mouth of the Yukon was, but we didn't know where the top of the Yukon was. And it hadn't been so very many years since the top of the Yukon was known as Lewis River. It's spelled L-E-W-E-S. And so this Camel, he had a he built a he come in from the Liard, up over the Liard, and come to the headwaters of the Pelly River. And he came down there and built a fort there. But the Indians burned him out there. And not it wasn't the local Indians that did it. It was the Indians from the coast used to come in as traders, and the Hudson Bay Company were just infringing on their territory. So they just burned him out, and it was he gave up his posting.
When I come up to Yukon in 1908, the Captain Powell told me about the Lewis River is the shortcut to come up the Yukon. They can take the Lewis River and save I don't know how many miles. But we had to take the old Big Delta route because the river was so low. And then we hung up and we was there 48 hours. Tide had gone out and there was five boats of us that high and dry there until the tide came in again to raise our boats. And they talked about the Lewis River and they were saying, well, they couldn't go up the Lewis River because the river's too low now. They had to take the old, but when the rivers are full, they take that as a shortcut and it saves miles of coming up the Yukon from St. Michael.
I talk with some old people. I talk with everybody on the rivers. That's where you learn things, you know. I talked with a lady there. I can think of her name. Can't think of her name right now. Just a wonderful lady. She lived there for years and years and years at a place called Coffee Creek. And then she moved from there to Quickman Creek. And she lived there for years. And she told me a story an old steamboat captain told her. He said there was a on one of the boats, there's one of them sort of individuals that has a lot of fun with the tourists. They ran a tourist boat there for a number of years from Whitehorse to Dawson. And so he had it fixed up with the cook that when he called him in for moose milk, why to bring in a little glass of water with a little bit of evaporated milk in there. Mm-hmm. So sitting at the table with all these tourists, why he'd tell about how wonderful moose milk was, and so many people, they just thought it was wonderful to drink moose milk. And so they asked some of the ladies there if they wanted to try it. And so one of them, she was quite bold, and so she said, yes, she wouldn't mind trying it. So he called Charlie the cook in, and told her to bring in a little bit of moose milk. Lady wanted to taste it. So we brought in this glass with the water and a little bit of moose milk. And after she tasted it, why, he says, well, how does it taste? And she said, well, don't you know, it tastes just like milk, evaporated milk. And the captain says, that's what they all say.
Well, did the Hudson's Bay Company use York boats to supply Fort Yukon and that area?
No, Charles. They used Fort Yukon boats. I think the name of the boat takes its name from what I think was first built. That gentleman over there, I think, is quite knowledgeable about these things. If I say something wrong, why are you speak up? I think it was built maybe at a place called York Factory. They were about 40 feet long, and they were sharp-pointed, and they used a great big square sail when they could. And they were a clumsy thing, but they did move them over portages. And the way they moved them over portages was rollers. And that's the way some of these Sardos did, too, at the, up at Rat Pass. I still saw some of them rollers. It looked to me like that might have been rollers. There wasn't no trees around there. And so those big boats didn't get to Fort Yukon by no means, but they did get down the Mackenzie. And I saw a picture here, and I tried to count the number of men on it. And I don't know if they always use that number of men, but the picture I counted the men on, I counted 13 men on the line. Can you just imagine that? 13 men walking up along the river in moccasins, in the water, probably up to their waist almost at times. One Indian there at a Klavik, and they are Indians there too, not all Eskimos, told me his grandfather worked for 3 months for a tent. One place I want to make a trip someday is from Athabasca Landing. It's really Athabasca down to the Clearwater. They have a railroad there now to bypass. That was so terrible in the early days. In the very first early days, getting to the North Country, they come up a series of lakes called Churchill Waters. And then there was a long portage, I forget how many miles, and it was quite steep. And it goes to the Clearwater River, which is about 80 miles up the Clearwater from the Athabasca. Then they came down the Clearwater to the Athabasca. And then on down to Lake Athabasca and the Slave River. They have a portage of about 18 miles. It's been and always have been there. And they have trucks and everything around that now. But everything went around there. The boats that they used there on the big steamboats, they had to use three of them. One of them was used on the upper Athabasca. It went as far as Fort McMurray, or what they call a Border Rapids, or Grand Rapids, I think it was, because no big boats could go through there. The portage there is over an island. But below there, then, they used another boat. And this other boat serviced the lower Peace River as far as up as the Vermilion Chutes, and they went down the Slave River as far as Fort Smith is. That was the second boat. And then there was a third boat operated below Fort Smith for the lower rapid. I can't think now just when the first boat was on the lower Mackenzie. It was about 1890s, I think it was.
Well, you mentioned those burning coal fields. Are they out now?
I didn't know if they spoke when I came by. But I talked with the man there at Fort Good Hope, and he thought there was, way down deep in there. I was burning in Alexander's time, like I say, in 1789. It's way down, I guess, in there. Is it right?
Yeah.
What year were you down there?
The healing? Oh, I have never been down there.
Oh.
I was on the, I think, the canoe trip up to Porcupine from the Bell River. I went on up to the
ship. Did you come down last summer?
No, I was down there about 5 years.
There was some young man that came down there by himself. Nobody could, I heard about it at Old Crow. By the way, there's... Yeah.
From the Bell or above?
Well, no, that's what we don't know. But he just stopped there just for a few minutes almost and went on, so nobody... By the way, up at Old Crow, there's an interesting lady up there called Edith Josie. Maybe you have read some of her writings in the newspaper.
Yes, he got pictures of her and it's funny stuff they took of her.
Well, it's kind of interesting to know that lots of those writings have been compiled into a book. I think it's published in Whitehorse. I saw that book down at the mouth of the South Mahoney. A lady had a copy of it there.
Well, how about Eliza Steamboat? Is she still alive?
At Old Crow? I saw one real old lady there. Just awfully old lady. But I don't think it was Elijah Steamboat. I think that was the mother-in-law, I guess you'd say, of John Kennedy. He worked on a boat called Brainstorm. By the way, this Brainstorm, if anybody here is thinking about a canoe trip, there might be one way to get his canoe up to Old Crow. They freight between Dawson City and Old Crow. But believe it, last summer, they only made 2 or 3 trips. That's just how low the water was in last summer. So low, they could not operate their boat.
And so. Just as Darren, he mentions the Cadzows. He had pictures of Cadzow and his daughter on the river. And he mentions a lot of these people that you've mentioned tonight. And they went up way past it, Bell River.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1926. They were up for 3 months on that trip.
They went up to
Porcupine? Yeah, they went up to Porcupine way up.
I did too.
I think they have a copy, a private copy of his diary out at the university. I think he lived out there. Otto Geist
went up there.
Yeah, well, Otto Geist.
1953, I read his diary. He went up the fishing branch. I went up the
mountain. Otto Geist is one that had his secretary type. Justice
Diary,
and they have a copy of it out there.
Who, was that your husband?
My husband, yes, and I have his diary at home. Thank goodness it wasn't in the box in the flood. I lost so much. And thank goodness I sent all his pictures of that trip at Evanita University place. I have all his pictures of that trip up the Old Crow and all these people. I have the films. I have all the films. And I boxed them up and sent them to my son when I sold the homestead. I'm glad I did. I lost everything in the flood.
Mm.
So he has those films out there. Did
you mention that was much of a game country up there?
They didn't see Devon's game, no. They got themselves a caribou and a bear and things on the way. But fish, oh boy, the pictures of his fish, trout, and grayling, great big grayling, and he did a lot of fishing. They lived on fish most day, I guess. They had a baby along too, and 9 month old baby took up there. Everybody thought this was crazy.
Have you read a book by James Carroll? He took 2 of his very young children. They were still changing daddies with them. He went up by Toboggan. I forget what year it was. He went up to Crow Flats to shoot muskrats.
Well, Marty has a short synopsis of his trip in her book, To in the Far North. She tells about the trip up. Did you read that book, To in the Far North, that Marty
Murray?
It has the library at the university, and it tells about going up to Porcupine. She has it there, because she and her baby, you know, and husband were just with their pilot there. It was our boat that he took them up in.
Well, they went up the Old Crow, I think.
They went up the Old Crow and the Porcupine. Way up the Porcupine, oh yes, uh-huh. And you read her To in the Far North. She has one whole chapter there on this trip. Of course, you don't go into detail like his diary. His diary tells everybody that he met and how much gas they used and what they did, and they cash gas, you know, some places. And the motor broke, burned out in the boat, and they lined that darn barge up. They lined that all the way up the port town. They lined up by boat, by you know, poling and ropes. They took that.
There was two brothers at Oak Grove at Fort Yukon for years and years. Their names were the Mason brothers.
Oh, yes, son, we know them well.
Rube and somebody.
Bill.
And they, Bill. And they used to pole up there.
Mason's a widow in Seattle now. Her
and they went many miles up there in the Porcupine.
She met them up there.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the canoe and the picture that you have? Now, that's a large canoe. That's birch bark.
Would you mind? Let me get that.
No, I'll get it.
Okay.
You folks are all with your names on that would you say for down there. Would you like to see it?
Night, Robert. Thank you for coming. Thank you. Now, this is between 35 and 40 foot long, and this is the birch bark canoe. There's no piece of metal in it. The French early Canadians had a name for this man. I think it's I can't speak French, but I think it's Gouvernil for the bowman, and they had a name for the sternman. I can't remember that. These people here were called middlemen. Their paddles, as you notice, are very narrow. They could, I guess, and have taken about 60 strokes a minute, but usually it's around 40. And 40 seemed like quite a lot, but I can make 40 strokes too.
Do you need that many to get the boat through, or are they just
They could haul between 4 and 5 tons in that boat. But of course, normally freight boats wouldn't have this many people in there. They have maybe about 8, I think, something of that nature. But this big canoe is only used on the early part of the route, like for instance from Montreal. They just go about 9 miles to Ottawa. And they went up the Ottawa, I think it was to a river called the Matta, M-A-T-T-A-W-A, I believe. And it took them, I think, into Lake Nipissing. And then they went out there on the river, it might have been called French River. And that took him into Lake Huron. But I think there's a bay there, though, on Lake Huron. Can you think of that bay there? No, I was thinking this particular
North Channel.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they come out there in Lake Huron there, and then they passed what we now know as Sault Ste. Marie. That's what it was. Georgian Bay. They come into Georgian Bay and then passed over the portage there, Sault Ste. Marie, into Lake Superior. And that was a very treacherous, like all great big bodies of water, is a very treacherous and risky thing, and particularly the North Shore. But that's what they followed. They followed the North Shore then, all the way around to what they call the Grand Portage. This is right opposite an island, which is called Isle Royale. And for interesting thing right there, this island has been stocked with wolves and moose. And it gives them a very good chance there to study wolves and moose.
One of these Murray boys was on Isle Royale for a year. F. Adolph, he was over on the mm-hmm.
Well, that was used to be the meeting point between, and that's as far as this canoe went. Then they took a smaller canoe from there called a North Canoe. But that was also the meeting point once a year for all the factors to meet there at this place. They're rebuilding that now, I think, around a big stockade there. So that's where this big canoe is. With you just in the first part.
You wonder where they get enough long poles to make it strong, don't you, to
that was painted by a lady who was the wife of the secretary to the what they call the Little Emperor. That was George Simpson. He was a tremendous business person, and he's long dead now.
The copy of her painting.
Yes, and she was she went right along with her. I've saw this a number of times. Here, I think last year, or well, when in 1867, you know, they have their centennial too, the Canadians do. They run a canoe trip. They had one of these great big canoes, or almost that big. It's made by the Chestnut Canoe nowadays. They're not that large. I'd say there's about 20 foot. They started Rocky Mountain House on the Saskatchewan. That's above Edmonton. And they went down the rivers, Saskatchewan and so on, and came to Montreal in this type canoe.
How long ago was the original painting?
This, I was going to tell you about this painting I saw in the, it was in the Alaska Sportsman. I think it was on the outside.
I think 63. The painting was painted in 63.
Just 1 second right here, I got a thing. Hell, I'll read this to you if I don't bore you. It says, with vigor, I didn't write this. I got this from the Minnesota Historical Society. I get several other things from there. They have a very nice place, very nice place. With vigor and realism, the artist portrays a huge canoe plunging through the swift current of a rapids which emerged from a lake. The 16 canoe men, with paddles poised, eyed the rock with intense concentration, as do four passengers, two men and two women. I'm going to tell you right there, these canoes never touched bank. They were loaded while there was afloat and unloaded while there was afloat. And if they had women passengers, or if they had fancy pants passengers who would have who would want to wade the water, they were piggybacked out and loaded on the canoe. I might tell you a little story right there, again, if I don't bore you. This wife of Lady Simpson was her name. She went with her husband on a number of trips, and she tells about one portage they went over right after a big heavy rain, and they had to walk through a pretty good sized water puddle. And the women didn't want to walk through that muddy water, naturally. And so this Frances, the wife of the George Simpson, she was light. So the Indian, the big Indian there, he carried her right along too, just like nothing. But another Indian lady there, another friend of hers, she was a big, heavy-set woman. And so this Indian, though, he tried to carry her too. And when he got right in the middle of this mud puddle,
oh, no.
He told her, he was holding her like this. And he told her, well, he just couldn't possibly carry her any farther. She'd just have to get around his neck. And so some way out there in the middle of that pond, she managed to get both legs around his neck and get up on top of him. But when she did, everybody just started to laugh like mad. And it got the Indian laughing too, see? So the first thing you knew, they both fell down in the mud. This lady, by the way, is Mrs. Hopkins. She, father was a well-known English painter, and I've heard about him too. His name was Beechey, Francis Beechey. She married this man Hopkins and came to Canada. This painting was made about 1879.
Well, is there anything left at the New Rampart House?
Yes. The store there and the big two-story house is standing there.
Is Frost still there? Frost and his family, weren't they at Rampart House?
Jack Frost died several years ago. Are you thinking of Bluefish, the mouth of Bluefish?
No.
That's where they lived
right
for years.
The mouth of the porcupine there, the Frost family were there. He was the U.S. commissioner or something.
No, he was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Royal Canadian Mounted Police, that's where he was.
Yeah.
And he was there, and Jeff had pictures of him and mentions he and his family.
Well, he retired, I guess, a number of years ago.
Once in a while,
Yeah. No, but his wife was there. I talked with her at this time. Mrs. Frost. And I know one of her daughters real well. That is, I'm familiar with her husband, too, of course. She's married to a trapper in Fort Yukon. Joe Ward's adopted son, Jim Ward. But he was quite a character, Jack Frost was.
He must have been, so I guess.
He got caught one time going up the Porcupine with a big load of bread. He got caught in the ice there in the fall. And he lived on bread for about 2 weeks or so. Mm-hmm. Finally, they flew him out. Plane come in, pick him up, throw him out. Looks funny, though, to see in a newspaper, Jack Frost got caught by the frost.
Well, how about Old Rampart House?
Old Rampart House, that's a real pretty spot. And that's a real pretty... Pardon? Uh-huh. It's real pretty there. There's an unusual stone right there, too. You notice that little stone right at the mouth? Salmon trout.
Beautiful little stream comes in there.
Well, there's one cabin there, and it looked to me like it's been a mighty fine cabin, too.
On the left limit?
Yep.
Both sides. Up or down?
Yeah, left
side.
Well,
I think the original settlement was on the left limit, wasn't it?
I'm not positive about that.
Well, there's cabins on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I know there's cabin on both sides. I just stopped this time, the ones on the right side coming down, but I did, and we stayed there 2 days. I couldn't get them people. I tried to get them German couple to get over that ground, because I really passed some miserable times going in there in the fall, and I mean miserable, rain and so forth.
No place to camp once you leave the Rampart.
Yeah.
Going up to the Holling Dog Rock, about how the trouble they had landing the boat around the Holling Dog Rock.
What was the interesting thing, though, the way it turned out, we had unusually dry and unusually beautiful weather. So I was so happy after all that they didn't listen to me, because I just went through there like nothing. I average on the rivers around 50 miles a day on any kind of river's got a current. But of course, you know, a day means from the time you start to the time you stop.
Well,
no union R's, you know.
How about Canyon City or
Canyon Village? I was sleeping cold down through there. Of course, I figured it wouldn't take this long. I was 90 days on a river. And I figured that I'd be out there before it got too cold, so I didn't carry too much bedding. And I wanted so bad to pick up something there. There wasn't a soul there.
Have they abandoned the...
I guess so. There's not a soul there when I came through there.
Yeah, I see Simon Francis over at Chalkeesie.
Yeah, I see the paper where he is, and his daughter passes my house about every day. I talk with her once in a while. She's here to go to school. I know them, Simon and Francis. I tried to buy their cabin there called Old Settlement, and but Indians don't want to sell a white man a cabin. I don't know for sure, but I just suspect that it maybe has something to do with land claims. That's what I can think. I tried to buy that cabin. I tried to buy the cabin at Burnt Paul. We're talking about New Rampart. I was trying to think of the name of the people there that had that place left. Can't think of it. But Mr. Lottie, talking again about New Rampart. When I came through there, there was a lot of beads on the floor there I didn't take. I'm sorry I didn't, because I know Mrs. Cadzo, and I could have paid her for them. Now they're worth about $10 a piece. It's the old trade bead. But what I wanted to tell you on the wall was a trader's license for Mr. Cadzo.
For him?
It was for 28...
Correspondence upstairs there from the boundary survey in 1912.
a big book.
Mark Anthony, I don't know who he is, but he's here all over that country. He walked up before you found the guy.
I've heard of him.
Well, yeah. How about the little chapels there? There was two chapels. One of them had a little a glass, a leaded glass window.
Well, I think I was in the one that you referred to, and the floor has been taken up, and the windows is all out, and it's just a shell there. But it's still in better shape than those
that's
other couple.
It's just been somewhere else.
That moved out, probably.
Maybe. Uh-huh. But what I want to tell you, if that would be of any interest to the Historical Society, I'd be glad. And I also have a book about So Wide. I think I got it there, too. It's about that thick. It's about all the commodities that fur trading posts would buy. And I think it's about 1928 or so.
You picked it up?
I picked it up. I've offered these things to... Mr. Cadzo's daughter, who lives at Fort Yukon, but they're not interested in them, and I'm kind of glad they're not, because they just throw them on the shelf someplace, see, and I can give them to somebody someday.
Well, we'd be happy to take them. We have, of course, been collecting these things and giving you a receipt for them, and we will put them in the Pioneer Historical Museum, which is out of the Alaska land. If you have an opportunity of seeing it, there are
this little trapping list is about soul, and it could be put in between this kind of stuff,
surely.
And everybody could see it, and they wouldn't have heard it any.
Well, there was a little...
thank you, ladies, for coming.
There was a little baptismal font there with a silver bowl in it, and it had some prayer or something written in Indian in the center of it. In the bottom of the bowl. I just wonder if that's still there.
No.
Well, I think.
Else
well,
else.
I tell you, perhaps what happened. I alerted the ministers at
Old Fort
Fort Yukon about it, and possibly they made arrangements to have it picked up.
Well, I have an idea though. I know the last time. Let's see. Not the last time, but the second time I come through there, I think, was 1956. And the mounted police was coming down that inventory at that time. They had that great big book in there. It's a great big book. It's about this size. It tells all about the Alaska Survey. Pictures in it and everything. And just about that time, I'd read in the Seattle paper, well, there's a man down there, and I guess he's still there, that will evaluate old books. And so I give this address to Tommy Carroll, who married Cadzo's daughter, Nellie. And they wrote to them, but they never got an answer. And the idea is with that man, if he doesn't answer you, well, then the book isn't worth much. So I guess the book wasn't worth much.
Yeah, I've seen copies of the survey. It's a great big book. It has some fantastic pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they started from the north and the south simultaneously, the 141st meridian.
Mm-hmm. One thing you didn't mention there is that the line between Canada and Alaska is right through the center of New Rampart House.
Yeah. I saw a marker there not this time, but once before. If I remember right, stands about so high.
Right. They're bronze.
Metal. Bronze. On the Yukon, you can see a big slash through there. At least the last time I've been by there. I was thinking about, I'm going to make that trip. After next year, I'm going to make this Yukon once again. I'd be the third time I've been down there. But I've never been all the way before. This time I plan to go to Russian Mission, and then I'm going to go over that portage. There's a 40-mile portage there from the Yukon to the Kuskokwim, and it's through a series of lakes. And they used to use that years ago. I think the mail even used to be carried over there.
They had rollers through there, didn't
they? Did.
Were
they
rolling?
Oh yes, yeah. A tramway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A gentleman told me once he went home there during high water in a motorboat to school.
Bud?
A gentleman told me that he went from the Yukon to the Kuskokwim during high water by motorboat.
Oh, is that so?
No.
Well, that's interesting to know. I wrote two letters down there trying to get some information on it. I didn't know who to write to. But one Eskimo Kauskag I wrote to on the custard cream, and she wrote to me finally and gave me a name.
I think of his name. He used to be with the National Park Service and was a representative.
Wouldn't be McGee.
Well, he'd be here, Grant Pearson.
Yeah.
I did get a man's name, the name, I think, of McGee.
No, it was Grant Pearson.
Pardon?
Grant Pearson.
Oh, Grant Pearson. Oh, that was the man at Mount McKinley.
Yeah.
What, do you write a book here? Will, my High Adventure?
Yeah.
High Adventure. Mm-hmm. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm real interested in North Country. I've read so much about it. And I've read so much about the West all my life. And I enjoy talking about it. And my wife, anymore, when people come at the house, and I start talking, she goes out in the kitchen. So I don't know how you people feel about it, but I never get tired of talking about the North Country.
She's not like Mrs. Parker. Mrs. Parker got jealous because Mr. Parker had pictures, you know, from way back when.
Mm-hmm.
And when people come, you get the pictures out of them, and they talk, you know. And when David took all the pictures and burned them up, she said,
she did?
Yes, uh-huh. And oh, she, boy, were they mad, and the Parker boys and all, they couldn't. They just thought, well, she never thought about they might want them or something, you know, or give them to the boys. And then she threw them in the stove and burned them up. Pictures that she could get her hands on there.
Yeah, no, it must have been his father.
Not Carl's, no, his father. His father would, you know, show pictures, must have talked to old days, as all old timers do when they get together, you know, and she wanted people to visit with her. And so she got mad one day when the they're both gone now. And he just passed away not too long ago back east with his daughter Genevieve. And she took the pictures from the stove because she was jealous of the, it was a terrible thing, you know. And so sometimes, you know, you should think of those things because the women do get a little tiresome of that, but if they can find something else for them to do, so
did you
get tired? I have to get in on it all the time. I don't know when to keep still.
Did you ever hear of a man by the name of Hornby? That story about 1925. He was a man over in eastern Canada who would go out in the barren lands and sometimes dig out a wolf den and live in it. And he'd give away and throw away his food. He used to give it to the Indians before he got in there because for some reason or other he wanted to live right off the land. And you know, that's a very bad thing to figure on, because lots of times game is not when you need it and you can't get it. This guy's name was Hornby, and he took people were getting kind of shying off from him about going with him anymore. So in England he talked to two of his relations to go with him. One was a young boy, I think about 19, and they went into the barren lands and the caribou didn't show up. They're on the Thelon River where this happened at. And this young boy kept a diary all his time. The first man to die from starvation was Hornby himself. Then the next man died, and this young boy was the very last one to die. And he kept a diary right up until he died. And just before he died, he opened the stove door, and that's what reminded me of this. And in the ashes, he put the diary. Then he put a note up on top of the stove and says, "Look in stove." And that's how they know about that tragedy. Yeah. It's quite a guy. Hornby. Yeah, Hornby. Sometimes I get mixed up because there's a river right there that joins the Thelon called the Hanbury. But this is Hornby.
Well, Mr. Wolf, I think we've sort of exhausted
the viewing
here for, and it's been a most pleasant evening. I think everyone has enjoyed it very, very much. And
thank you, Mr. Tom.
I know that we've had several people who are apparently avid canoeists this evening, and we're very pleased to have them.
You've been a good better grow down Historical Society. He'd be interesting to have as a member.
Ma'am?
Yeah.
You'd be interesting to have for a member by Historical Society. Maybe you better sign your...
Well, thank you.
I'd like to come with you and come to our meetings.
Thank you. I'm interested in that, but this is the first time in 11 years I've been home.
You could be an absentee member.
Yeah. That's the way it is with my lodge over in Honolulu. Still an absentee member.
Of course, sir. We would appreciate those things.
November 1968, the Tano Yukon Historical Society dedicated the monument, a centennial monument, at 1st and Lacey Street, the site of the first home of Judge Wickersham. The following comments are by the Master of Ceremony, Lloyd Hoppner, a Fairbanks attorney, and Judge Forbes, a retired judge in the Fairbanks area.
Now, this is an occasion that the Tanana Yukon Historical Society has looked forward to for quite some time now, and as you can see behind us here, we have an old service station being burned down. And last summer, of course, we had the house of Judge Wickersham that was moved out of here. And looking at it now, with this new service station here, you would never know that there was a historical site here in the sense of Judge Wickersham's old cabin. This is happening all over town. We hope to do this more often. I think you will agree after the cloth has taken off of the monument here that this is a very nice looking plaque. We have one other, and we hope to have dozens more before we're done and place them in similar spots. This plaque here was gotten by the Historical Society 2 years ago during the centennial year, summer, from the Alaska Centennial Commission, who graciously cast these for us. And Judge Forbes was the chairman of that commission. He is also a former jurist himself. And for those reasons, I think it is very appropriate that he is the one to say a few words in dedication of this monument today. So, Judge, if you would please.
Folks, the importance of an occasion cannot be called without Pat Paulson, the commander in town, as you all know. And thousands met him at the airport, and thousands hauled him to the Patty Gymnasium. That doesn't make it important. The fact that there's just a handful here does not make this occasion unimportant. Of course, the occasion isn't as important as the works of this great man we are to honor today. I am proud to take part in this little ceremony. On this very ground, the Honorable James Wickersham built a home, largely with his own hands. But he had been building all of his life. He came to Alaska and became very much interested in the affairs of Alaska. He was a representative in Congress, was the first man to introduce a statehood bill for Alaska. He was not only a very competent and honored jurist, but his interest went beyond. He was interested in the various things. He wanted to know what Chena meant. He followed the Chena. He followed the Yukon. He traveled all over this area and dug to. Many people leave this earth and are soon forgotten. This man will never be forgotten. Even children today and children of tomorrow will be reading about this great man and will appreciate his contributions to Alaska and to the United States. So, I, with great reverence, wish to dedicate this spot to the memory of that great jurist and great man, Judge Wickersham. Inscription, Wickersham, what the judge says is true,
I'm just delighted to be here for the unveiling, and I just think it's a wonderful plan that the Historical Society has done, and I'm pleased to be one of the CHIO members.
And announce your name as a
Adriana.